Good afternoon, everybody. So my presentation is largely about the experience that we had in providing technical assistance to the Ministry of Health on one of our projects, which got over in 2012. It was called the IFPS, which is the Innovations in Family Planning Services Technical Assistance Project. Now, it's a mouthful, but the Innovations in Family Planning Services Project, IFPS, was a USAID-funded project in partnership with the government. And it was such a project where the government put in half of the money and the donor agency, or USAID, put in half of the money to implement projects and test various public-private partnership models for reproductive health and family planning. And to help the governments do that, USAID put out a project called the Technical Assistance Project, which was then implemented by Futures Group and various collaborating partners. So the overall objective of the project was to reduce fertility and improve reproductive health in overall India and three states in the northern Indian region, one of which is highly populated, which is Uttar Pradesh, and its population, like I was telling somebody this morning, is almost as large as Brazil, the country itself. So huge, huge populations and extremely dense. So that was one of the states. And the other two states also had pretty high populations and maternal and infant mortality. So the project was to increase quality of family planning services, improved use of these services, and overall increase the use of reproductive health services. And this project, when it began in 2005, that was also the period when the government launched its National Rural Health Mission. So the project, in a sense, was about providing technical assistance to the government to implement the projects better. So this was how it worked. So there was support at the national level, which is the Ministry of Health and Family Welfare. And there were two projects. One was ITAP, and then there was another project called MCHIP, implemented by JAPAIGO. And at the state level, there were these state institutes or family health and family welfare societies that worked closely with the projects. So this is like the background to give you a sense of how it all went about. So the project developed was based on an approach of the 5D, which is developing, designing, demonstrating, documenting, and then disseminating what was done. And it may sound slightly theoretical or on paper, but this is actually put into practice when you talk of the various stages of which the project went through. So, what did the project do when it came to behavior change communication? A lot of state-level behavior change communication strategies were developed that then were adopted by the governments. A blueprint for a national health program on the public broadcasting channels, Doordarshan and the radio, where a content matrix was developed for all the reproductive child health initiatives and family planning, and various briefs were given to them so that the producers of various shows on television, on the public broadcasting television and radios, could then have ready-made briefs to work on. Then around 35 television commercials, 14 radio commercials were developed, numerous print ads were developed. An advocacy film was developed because NRHM, like I mentioned earlier, was launched in 2005, so people had to know about this huge government-run health program. And then there was a television serial. There were exhaustive interpersonal communication toolkits that were developed for community-level workers. They are called the ASHAs. And a lot of 360-degree multimedia campaigns. Now, this was the project from 2005 to 2012, and we are here to share what we learned from those projects in how we got the governments to adopt behavior change communication as part of their health systems. So first, it needed to be in sync with the needs and the goals of what the government wants to achieve. So be it their timelines, be it their focus areas for the year, be it the budgets that they have, all of that was very important to ensure buy-in and ownership from the government. It may sound, yeah, that's it's supposed to be done, but it was that was the biggest challenge. So you had to propose things that they could see they were able to do. Then providing vicarious learning experiences from time to time. So each time when we take a proposal to them, we had to talk the language of behavior change communication. All our documents had to have the various steps or the processes that are involved in creating a good campaign inbuilt into the document. Conversations had to be interspersed with behavior change communication jargons, and as and when possible, you know, sharing of important and interesting documents or findings and research had to be done. So this was the governing board of the Population Stabilization Fund, which is part of the ministry, a quasi wing of the ministry working on population control. So they're discussing a 5-year communication and advocacy plan. Then we realized that the weapon we had in our hands was formative research and pre-testing. Many a time, bureaucrats and people in the public health at the government, they think they know it all. They think they are the experts, so they know how to communicate. They think they have the technical information, so they know how to print, make the toolkits. And the only answer we had was, okay, let's pre-test it, or let's see what our formative research tells us about this. So when we took that route, they were able to listen to or agree to, you know, okay, we're not going to do this, but we'd rather do this. So it was a good way to contend what they were saying, and especially on the imagery, layout, creatives, messaging, etc. So we used that extensively. Realistic timelines. Many a times when the ministries told us, you know, hey, we want to develop a 7 TV commercial campaign on family planning, they would say we want it in the next 2 months. And you're like, no, we can't develop a good campaign in 2 months. And the best way then for us to contend that was to give them a realistic timeline that had all the steps in there. So right from, you know, formative research, creating a storyline, developing a script, developing rough cuts, developing a storyboard, pre-testing the rough cuts. And within that, we put in rounds of reviews, because in the government, it can take a long time to get everybody to consent and provide review on, at each stage. So then we said, okay, review time, 3 days from your end, 3 days from our end. And review at the time of script, storyboard, rough cuts, and that's it. So then they realized that, okay, I might be able to, if we were developing a commercial on family planning, let's say, then we would only be able to get the family planning experts. We will not get in the reproductive health experts, we would not get in the child health experts, we would not get in some other expert. But so that restricted the number of reviews that were going to happen and the number of people were going to comment on the products themselves. So that was one way we did that. And I'm sure you may know all this already, which is how to set realistic timelines. So at the planning stage, include formative assessment, barrier analysis, or desk review. And if projects have already done it, then you can say that, hey, you know, we already have it, so here's how you can make it faster. At least 3 rounds of approval, like I mentioned. And the approval and limiting the review also helps the creative agencies who are producing that content for us. Because we have limited funds, they have to work in limited budgets, and the more you ask them to change or modify or improvise, the product is only going to get less creative. Their motivation or the creativity of the producers also goes down along with it. And like I said, pre-test. Test for comprehension, appeal, intent to act, intent to change, look and feel of actors, and then the government will not contain what we want to then put out as a final product. Being professional, being friendly, understanding, having a very professional relationship with all level with people at all levels was very crucial. Staying away from office politics that exist even within the ministries was very crucial, because we knew we had to get our work done, and this was how it had to be. And over a period of time, we came to be respected and trusted for that. So that's Dr. Narayana, who is the advisor at Futures Group, in conversation with some of our other government counterparts. So the results. So what did we achieve because we did this? the three states where we worked in, which is Uttarakhand, UP and Jharkhand, then had state BCC strategies, which then became the blueprint for all the states, and the Ministry of Health recognized that. Then each year in India, all the states develop a program implementation plan, which is a PIP. And they set out targets and budgets for the year. And that plan goes to the ministry in Delhi, the national ministry, and it gets approved. So the state implementation plan of these three states where the project worked continues to have BCC plans and separate funds for behavior change communication since 2010 till now. Then, like I mentioned, Swasth Bharat, which was the national program on the public broadcasting channels, again, BCC is at the core of it, and they've taken a life stage approach. So they're thinking reproductive health, maternal health, neonate health, child health, adolescent health. So that entire gamut now looks at a behavior change approach rather than just an information or an awareness generation approach. Then the Ministry of Health is now creating an online repository of all the stuff that has happened, which is in the realm of behavior change communication. So all the donor agencies and development partners, and so organizations like PHI, PSI, JAPIGO, Futures, Johns Hopkins Center for Communication Programs, everybody is coming and pulling the resources and providing content to the online repository. Then materials have been repackaged and reused over and over again because the issues in that sense have not changed, but the appeal changes. So packages have been made and have been used in various ways. So again, cutting down or, you know, using to the maximum existing resources. And for an example, the booklet on family planning, which the project created, has now been launched and shared with all the states to replicate. And this was launched last year at the World Population Day. So here's to give you an example. This is the Swasth Bharat show. The first picture has Doordarshan, which is the public broadcasting channel in Guwahati, which is one of the states, and the health minister of India is in the Delhi studio, and they're having a public like a chat show. And this is one of the state BCC strategy launch. And that's all. Thank you very much. So do we take questions now, or?
Okay.
Any questions? Was I too fast? Do I need to clarify something? Yes. No. Can I take the questions first?
I had a similar question. I'm with Chemonix International, and I noticed in the beginning you talked about the results that you were trying to achieve were a reduction in fertility, increasing quality, the results that you talked about were sort of the outcome of the actual program itself.
Yes. Okay. So I'll start answering. One on evaluation. There was an evaluation. Okay. This project had various other elements as well. So there were various models of public-private partnerships that were implemented, piloted, and then scaled up. Behavior change communication was just one part of it. There was research, monitoring, and evaluation as an entire set across various activities that the project did. So definitely there was, and I don't have the results of the outcomes of the project with me, but for example, family planning has increased, CPR increased through social marketing, social franchising. There was an increase in institutional deliveries through voucher schemes and social franchising, that which was implemented. But here, this presentation largely highlights the how the governments now have begun to think behavior change communication, and then what were some of the results of that. But I can guide you to the reports, a whole lot of reports that have been developed and published. They are on our website, and I'll give you the link to that. So this project had social marketing of contraceptives to the rural areas. This had social franchising for maternal and health and child health services. It also had institutional capacity building and trainings at the national and the state level. It also had voucher schemes, mobile medical health units, and things like that. So the project tested a lot of public-private partnership models for health service delivery, and behavior change communication was one integral part of all of them. So yes, there was evaluation done, but not exactly on BCC, but on the project as a whole. There were baselines done, there were end lines done, and then there were mini surveys, maternal death audits done. So there's a whole range of research that was done under the project. And to answer your question on a material-free, so to speak, health system, I don't think, you know, when we talk of public health or when the government is putting out something, they don't cater to the specifics. You know, they go broad-based. And in that sense, anything that the government does largely is more standardized than specific to a community. So keeping that in mind, I think what the government of, at least the Ministry of Health at the center can do is to send out prototypes or to, you know, put out those generic kind of communication campaigns that then states can adopt and adapt. So, for example, the family planning booklet was one example of it. So they gave out this booklet and said, you know, this is the idea. You modify it into whatever you want. And because health is a state subject back in India, so each year the national at the national level, they just give out their priorities for that year, and the states then have to see what is it that they want and what they're going to put out. And in a place like India, I think if you provide a material free, if you suggest that, it will largely mean no materials at all. So that's the, you know, dilemma that I think even still now we have it. But we can talk about that later. Any other questions? Great.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
What an excellent presentation.
So there you go. Can you join us?
Yes. Hi there. I am Sabrina Egan. I'm a technical advisor at John Snow Inc., JSI, based here in Boston. We have a project in Madagascar called the Mahefa Project, so I'm part of the team that supports that project. Let's see if I can get this. Okay. Part of this project, this presentation was actually prepared by two of our colleagues in Madagascar, Elize Ramamanjosa and Linda Morales. So they asked me to present it because they couldn't be here, but they deserve full credit for the presentation you're about to see. So the project in Madagascar is called the Community-Based Integrated Health Program. It's known as MAHEFA, which is a Malagasy word that means strong and able to accomplish something, and it's an abbreviation for strong and healthy families. It's a five-year USAID-funded project. We're almost at our midpoint in the project. It's implemented by JSI along with two partners, the Manoff Group and TransAid. We also work with 19 local Malagasy NGOs. We work in 6 regions in the northern and western parts of the island with 24 districts and 280 communes. Most of the areas, the health areas that we work in are MNCH, family planning, and WASH, and we have a number of other smaller projects that come into play in these areas. The population that we're working with is approximately 20-25% of the entire population of the island. It's about 3.5 million people. And just to give you an idea, the 6 regions that we work in haven't previously had donor support on a large scale. So we're working with community health workers in these areas, but a lot of times it's us to, first of all, identify the community health workers and train them and support them. So from a behavior change perspective, there's also a lot of work to do at the community level to get people aware of the different health interventions that are becoming available to them. So in terms of the context, the regions that we work in are very impoverished regions. Madagascar as a country is a very impoverished country, and they have a number of difficulties. Here you can see this woman is struggling to get enough water to take back to her home to meet all of the water needs in her home. The regions that we work in also have very serious access issues during the rainy season. So it doesn't look like there's a lot of water now, and then when the rain comes, it's a different kind of problem that people have. So we work with community health workers. These are 2 of our community health workers. We'll have about a total of 6,000 community health workers by the end of the project, and they are usually 2 per village. And those are some of the tools that I will be talking about that they work with. The first one is a family planning demonstration tool, and the second is a flip chart. So for our behavior-centered programming, so what were the key questions that we asked? We basically wanted to know, in our areas, what are the most powerful barriers and motivators to behavior change? Who are the key influencing groups for each behavior? What are the feasible actions for each behavior? What materials already exist to influence the behavior change decisions? And are they appropriate for our regions? Like I said, there were materials for other projects that worked in other parts of the country, and we had to assess whether or not they needed to be adapted for our regions. And finally, what were the channels that are currently existing and most effective to reach our priority groups? So we conducted different types of research. In all, we conducted 3,000 individual interviews through face-to-face qualitative and quantitative surveys. We did these interviews with the priority groups that were identified by individuals in our regions with specific characteristics related to each behavior. So when we have a total of 15 behaviors in MNCH, WASH, family planning, we actually did all the regions. So at this point, Mena Bay and Sophia, 2 of our regions, have been completed, but our process is ongoing for the other regions. What we wanted to do was we wanted to identify the major barriers and important motivators for each behavior. So in the Designing for Behavior Change matrix that we use, and many of you may have already seen, we want to get at the right and adequate formulation of the behavior, first of all, the behavior that we want to promote. We want to talk about what is the priority group's position on the behavior change scale. Are they aware of the behavior that we want to promote, and have they ever tried to adopt this behavior themselves? We also want to know what are their key groups of influence. Is it their husband? Is it their mother-in-law? So who are these people? For the determinants, we want to identify the main barriers and the key motivators, and then we want to be able to act on the perceptions to minimize these barriers and promote the motivators. Finally, the activities that we determine, we want to be able to address and offer solutions to the problems and to the difficulties that have been experienced by the priority groups in practicing the behavior. We also want to help maintain beneficial health behaviors that are already being practiced. We want to make sure our activities are high visibility to mobilize the community in general, and we want to favor the promotion of community dialogue to find local solutions to local problems. So here's an example of one of the behavior change matrices that we developed. The ideal behavior that we want is we want mothers of children under 5 to treat their water every day, year-round, and in all relevant locations. So not just at home, but if she travels to go visit other family members, she also is practicing the water treatment. Our priority group then, of course, is mothers with children under 5. They largely live in rural areas for the regions that we work in. They largely have a low literacy level, and they're poor and vulnerable families. Many of the women do participate in women's group meetings, and they definitely want improved living conditions for themselves and their families. A positive influence group for this particular behavior is the husbands of the women that we're targeting. So one of the things that we discovered is that the women had a perceived lack of self-efficacy in terms of they thought they didn't have enough firewood to constantly be treating the water for their children. So what we decided to do was we wanted to improve the perception of these mothers that the lack of firewood can be solved by using other methods of treatment, SOTIS or SURO, two other water treatment methods that don't require firewood. So one of the activities that we implemented for this behavior then was to have the CHW in the community collaborate with the women's group to have a water treatment demonstration session for both SOTIS and for SURO, just to get the women together and have them start talking about what it takes to actually use these methods. Some of the other approaches that we used in general were described in a guide and solutions manual for CHWs that I will get to in a minute. Some of the examples of different approaches include a care group whereby one family that has correctly adopted a healthy behavior then mentors other families in the community to also adopt that behavior. So that's a relatively small scale, family to family, but on a larger scale we also will do carnivals, which are high visibility activity to mobilize the community for important health events. This will be done around vaccination campaigns, International Health Days, Mother and Child Health Week, that kind of thing. And finally, as I just described, we also have demonstrations to actually demonstrate some of the new approaches that we want to promote in the community. There are other approaches as well, but these are some of the key ones that we've been using. So we have a couple of channels of communication that we're using in our project. The first is, of course, the CHWs. So they're trained in message transfer techniques and behavior change empowerment approaches for interpersonal discussions and group discussions. They're expected to work one-on-one, but also to do group sensitizations. This is an example, actually two examples of flip charts that we have for the project that the CHWs use. One is the one on the left is a maternal health flip chart, and the one on the right is a child health flip chart. They were actually developed by other projects working in Madagascar. But as I said, those projects worked in the south. So what we've done is we've taken that and adapted it for our regions with different dialects and different illustrations that are relevant to our regions. This is the guide and solutions book that I had mentioned earlier that has been developed by MAHEFA. It covers 17 different approaches to reaching the priority groups. It includes gender scenarios because gender is another aspect that we're looking at in our regions. All the approaches and scenarios are informed by a description of the main barriers to practicing certain behaviors as well as the motivators. It also gives the CHWs tips on how to direct the priority groups to choose the actions to take for the desired behavior, and it provides proposed solutions for the priority groups to overcome barriers. Another channel of communication we use is the radio, and this is, again, a two-pronged channel. We have a number of different kinds of radio messages that we develop, both short format and longer format, and those are broadcast in... We worked with 30 different local radio stations to broadcast those, and so those are broadcast to the general population. In selected villages, we also have listening groups so that people can get together, they can listen specifically to the radio messages that we've developed, and then they can have a discussion between themselves about what their reaction is to those messages, and they can come up with their own local solutions to issues like emergency transport, protection of water sources, those kinds of things, and other health issues that we talk about. It becomes especially important in these regions when it's the rainy season and access is quite difficult. And you can't always depend on somebody to come in with other forms of assistance. So that is it. Thank you for your attention, and appreciate you listening today. Thank you. So I'll take a few minutes for questions?
Yes.
Okay. So it's scenarios to have people think about the different ways that gender plays a role in their relationships. So it's a scenario, I know one of them is about a couple trying to decide, the child is sick, and the couple is trying to decide whether or not they should take the baby to a community health worker prepare if they should try and solve the problem on their own. And it's just to get a little bit of a sense of role play in terms of how to negotiate decision making from a gender perspective. And then there are others that also explore different gender.
Because of gender norms.
Right.
Are there other questions?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering, as you did your DBC and you were looking at all your barriers, what kind of methodologies did you use to decide your strategies for overcoming those barriers, and was the community involved in that process?
Yeah, and so that's a good question. The community was definitely involved. TIPS is a big part of the trial of improved practices is a big part of what we do. So getting people to try out the desired behavior and through that getting them to identify, you know, this is the barrier that's seen here and how can we all work together to overcome that barrier? Are there things that can be easily adapted so that kind of behavior is then accomplished? Okay. There are other questions? Yes?
I'd like to hear a little bit more about the listening groups. And were they facilitated? Was there any kind of facilitation guide, or how did that work?
Yeah, it is facilitated. It's actually been going on for a few months now, so we're scaling up as we go. But, yeah, it's facilitated. It's generally about 20 members in the Village Listening Group, and it's whoever wants to join. But we don't want it to get too big because then you lose the substance of the discussion. And they usually take place a couple times a month, each listening group. And we do have an evaluation plan for those, but hasn't taken place yet.
So.
Yes?
How do you mobilize, organize, and monitor your community? Because in India, we don't have very positive experiences.
You don't have which?
I mean, we don't have very positive experiences every time we have tried to apply systems for our daily programs. So how do you, I'm interested in understanding how to mobilize and organize.
Well, it's interesting. Sometimes they're organized through the CHW, so organized through people who already have some experience and some knowledge in the community. We also will, if the village wants us to train other people to be facilitators of the listening groups, we will do that as well. In terms of the monitoring, we're in the process of developing a tool to do better monitoring of the listening groups, because we do want them to, of course, be very productive in terms of having a substantial discussion, but you don't want the monitoring tool to be so heavy that then it becomes another exercise altogether. So we're in the process of trying to find that balance.
Yeah, I mean, because we have for a long time to understand whether the effort of taking these groups really adds to the project or not.
Right.
Because we have a big network of community leaders back in India, but is the groups actually all this doesn't appear to be the most cost efficient model. So it appears to be a very kind of improvement, but it has not been successful in the last 2 months.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting to hear. We've also been lucky enough to work with a local group that's given us radios. So from the cost perspective, in terms of supplying radios, that's not a cost for us. What we really need to worry about is whether or not we can get that many people together to actually have a substantial discussion. And so that's what we're focused on. Okay. Yeah. Yes.
My question was, are these community health workers through GSI or they're part of the public health system?
They're part of the public health system. CHW is a recognized cadre in Madagascar. Due to restrictions between the U.S. government and the Malagasy government, that's the only level we can work at right now because the U.S. government, USAID funding can't be used to support Madagascar government structures. That said, the CHWs are a recognized cadre, so we work through them. Prior to that, in most of the regions we work in, they hadn't yet been identified and they hadn't yet been trained and supported by the government.
So do they receive an incentive or a remuneration for doing what the project is doing, or
no?
Is it hand in hand with the government?
To the extent that we can work with the government, we follow the Madagascar National Policy on Community Health. We have some restrictions just because of the political situation, unfortunately. Madagascar is currently going through an election process, and Thank you.
Thank you. That was a really... Another really great presentation. Our next speaker is Jennifer Weiss, and I'm going to have her come on up. She can do a little bit more of her introduction. And do you want
to...
Hi, everyone. My name is Jennifer Weiss, and I am a health advisor with Concern Worldwide. And I support our child survival programs, one of which was in Burundi, which I'll be talking about today. I have no relationships to disclose. So just a quick overview of the presentation. I'll first be talking about what care groups are, and then I'll give you a quick description of an integrated or an adapted care group model that we developed in Burundi. And we ended up doing an operations research study on that. So I'll give you an overview of what the study was, what the results were, which are hot off the press. We just wrapped up the study last month, and then just talk about the future implications for community-based social behavior change programs. So that's a map of Burundi there, tiny little Burundi. It is bordered by Rwanda to the north, the DRC to the west, and then Tanzania to the south and east. And our program area was in one district called Mabai District with those three shaded commune areas in the north western part of the country. So just quick poll. Raise your hand if you are familiar with the care group model. Okay, so a couple people. So I'll just give an overview of what the model is for those that aren't familiar with it. Care groups are groups of 10 to 15 volunteer community-based educators. They are mothers in the community that themselves are either pregnant or have children under the age of 5 years old. These mothers are elected by their neighbors and regularly meet together for training on various topics. So in addition to just sort of themselves receiving training on, you know, health topics, they then go and visit their neighbors. So that each mother has about 10 to 15 neighbors that she then goes and transmits those messages to. So care groups are able to create a multiplying effect that equitably reach every household with a pregnant woman or child under five, and they're really heralded for this approach of really being able to cover every single household in the program area that has, you know, a beneficiary residing in it. So this is a diagram of what care groups usually look like. There's a cadre of project staff called animators, which is this top level here. And there might be, depending on the size of the project, maybe four of them, let's say. And they oversee a team of promoters who are also a part of the project staff, the nonprofit or the NGO. Each promoter then supervises a group of care groups. Usually it's about nine care groups. So a care group is a group of these mother leaders, they're called, this group of mother leaders that are meeting regularly. And the idea is that they meet, they receive the training on the health topic, they also sort of share their experiences in working in their communities together. And then after their training, each of these care group mothers goes and visits 10 to 15 households. So this is sort of the typical structure of the care groups. So as I mentioned, the key components of care group programs are that the care group meetings, the mothers meet together twice a month. They conduct home visits to their neighbor households about once a month. Sometimes they might also have sort of small group meetings with their neighbor households. They receive regular supervision. The care group volunteer mothers receive regular supervision from the promoter. And they also collect vital event data at the household level, which they're able to report. So if you're interested in learning more about care groups, there's a website called caregroupinfo.org, which I encourage you to check out for lots more information on that. So care groups are an extremely promising approach in the world of community-based social and behavior change. They've been implemented by over 20 organizations in about 25 countries. They were pioneered by World Relief in the 90s in Mozambique, and it's an evidence-based strategy that's really been proven to show high levels of behavior change, really high levels of behavior change, and some of that is now starting to come out in the literature, which is really exciting. But we really saw an opportunity for improvement with this model. So something that has been brought up time and again, why hasn't the care group model been taken on, is that it's really an NGO-led model. The structure, the core components of the care group model is reliant on project staff, the promoters, the animators that make this run, that are facilitating the women's group meetings, the care group meetings, et cetera. And even though they might encourage the Ministry of Health structures such as community health workers or health facility staff to sort of participate in care group activities, understandably, once the program ends, if they haven't really been trained in the functionality of this model, there's not a lot of potential for sustainability. So looking at this opportunity for improvement, CONCERN decided to develop what we called an integrated care group model. And we named it integrated because we wanted to reflect that it was integrated within the existing Ministry of Health community system. So this is what it looks like in Burundi. It's a very new community health system there, recently being developed as we speak. So at the top level, national level MOH, then there's the provincial level, in our case, a province called Cibitoke. Moving down to the district level, which in our case was the Mabai District Health Team. And then under the district level, there are the health facilities. This is very small little Burundi, so there's just 25 health facilities, government public health facilities in Mabai Health District. And then there are community health workers, about four per health facility. And again, these are recognized community health workers by the ministry system that are currently unpaid, although Burundi is starting to look at performance-based financing schemes. So in our program area, there were 152 community health workers throughout the district. And then there's, of course, the household level, where there were an estimated 107 households with women of reproductive age and children under five. So we wanted to know, okay, great, how can we extend the reach of these community health workers, 152, to reach 107,000 people? So we developed the integrated care group model. So this is a diagram of what ours looked like. So at the top level here, we have the district, the Mabai District Health Team, who is supervising health workers at the health facility. They're called titulaires in French and Burundi. They are then trained on sort of the key behavior change strategies, and then they train community health workers. Each community health worker then supervises the care group volunteers, and then the model works the same way with care group volunteers visiting their neighbor households. So the key differences in our model versus the sort of normal care group model is that we're using health facility staff instead of animators. Community health workers in Burundi are supervised by health facility staff, so we just sort of built on that existing structure of having health facility staff serve in that role. And we're using community health workers instead of NGO staff as promoters, with the key difference that whereas in the traditional care group model, most promoters supervise about 9 care groups, we tweaked this to have each CHW only supervising 2 care groups on average. So the questions that we wanted to answer under our operations research study was, does this integrated care group model achieve the same improvements in key knowledge and practices as the traditional model? We know the traditional model leads to high levels of change, so we wanted to know, can our adapted model do the same? We also wanted to know if the integrated model could function as well, and if it was as sustainable as the traditional model. So these were the questions guiding our research. This is a quick overview of the methods that we did. So we did baseline and inline population surveys to compare changes in 40 indicators, and we used a method called non-inferiority statistical testing, which I'll talk a little bit about as I present the results. when we looked at functionality, we looked at five key sort of operational indicators. We wanted to know about the percentage of households receiving at least one home visit from a care group volunteer each month, the number of care group meetings per month, meeting attendance. We wanted to compare those indicators between each of the two areas. And then for sustainability, with 6 months left in the project, we pulled out all of our support to care group activities in both study areas, and we just monitored these same operational indicators to see what happened to them once we withdrew our support. So it was a quasi-experimental cluster randomized pre-post study. That's what my research colleagues tell me it was. And what we did was divide the one commune. There were three communes in the district. We divided one of the communes up, and then based on population size, and then we randomly assigned one half of the commune to the traditional area and one to the integrated area. So in one part of our project, we did implement the regular old traditional model. We had promoters and the whole deal. And then in the other part of the commune, we did the integrated model. So you can see we had 51 care groups in the traditional area, 45 in the integrated area, and then, you know, the number of volunteers and target beneficiaries. So these were the sort of types of indicators that we looked at in terms of the first research question around, does the integrated model achieve the same level of knowledge and practice? So we looked at knowledge, for example, the knowledge of danger signs in sick children, the knowledge of food groups, the knowledge of components of a balanced diet. We looked at preventative practices, for example, hand washing and ITN use. We looked at sick child care-seeking practices, such as use of oral rehydration solution, care-seeking within 24 hours. And then we also looked at contact intensity. How much are people being reached by a health provider or by a care group volunteer? So this column is showing the total number, a total of 40 indicators, and the percent that were non-inferior was 90%. So what we mean by non-inferior is at least as good as. We decided that non-inferiority testing is normally used to demonstrate that a product is at least as good as whatever the functioning product on the market is, or that a drug works at least as good as the sort of current standard, and that's what we wanted to do. So it's a little bit awkward to say it was not non-inferior, so we say it was at least as good as. And in 36 out of the 40 indicators, we found that the integrated area performed at least as well in their performance of the indicators. So just to give you a little bit of context, these are some of the indicators around our wash behavior. So you can see from the baseline and end line in the traditional area and baseline and end line in the integrated area, we're just comparing the end line. So this is an example of an indicator where the integrated model was not as good as the traditional area, knowledge of providing increased food with diarrhea. However, in the other areas, we can see that the integrated area performed at least as well, if not better, than the traditional area. Okay, now I'm just going to talk about a couple of the functionality indicators, which we coupled with sustainability. So this is an indicator looking at the percentage of care group meetings with at least 80% of volunteer attendance per month. And this area over here is sort of while we were providing active support to the project, and this over here is the 6 months after we pulled out. The target here is 80%, and that's based on sort of international care group standards. And you can see the performance of the integrated and traditional area over time, sort of fluctuating, maybe the integrated area performing slightly higher even, but always above the target. And then when we pulled out, we can see that the traditional area sort of took a bit of a dip and then rebounded, but seemed to be holding steady. And then just one other sort of illustrative indicator around the percentage of households who are receiving visits by care group volunteers in the last month. We can see that the integrated area sort of took a while to catch up to the traditional area, but most of the time was above the standard, and that this trend largely continued even after we had withdrawn support to both areas. So just to sum up results, we see that the integrated model achieved at least the same improvements of key knowledge and practices, and that it functions as well, and it for now looks to be as sustainable as the traditional model. So just really briefly, some key learning. Main point of the study was that we find that CHWs are able to serve the role as health promoters, and this really has huge implications for the care group model. The Ministry of Health in Burundi has demonstrated really a keen interest in scaling up the integrated model. They see it as a way to extend the reach of community health workers to be able to reach every single household on at least a monthly basis, which they wouldn't be able to do otherwise. Of course, there's a lot of questions that we still need to answer to inform this scale up. Who would initiate it? Clearly, there's an ongoing role for NGOs as this approach is scaled up. How would behavior change materials be reproduced? How would supervision and quality control be provided? What are the costs, et cetera? So the discussion is ongoing. And I'll just conclude by saying that, you know, traditional care groups have been proven to be effective in improving key health and nutrition behaviors. And the integrated care group model really holds promise as a way to scale up promising practices at the household level while being integrated with the existing system. So thanks very much. I'll take a couple questions. Yeah.
When you switch to the integrated model for your evaluation, can you talk a little bit about what the community health workers would have been doing in their time otherwise if they hadn't taken over these responsibilities?
Sure. That's a good question. So concurrently with all of this, we were also working with the ministry to help implement community case management by CHWs, which is treatment at home of malaria, so far only malaria in Burundi. So that was sort of another piece. So they would have been, they were also doing community case management for malaria. And then if they hadn't been doing care group activities, like what they were doing in the traditional area was just sort of generally doing behavior change at the community level, community mobilization, sort of follow-up of pregnant women, but kind of on their own volition, you know, whatever they sort of were keen to do. Yeah.
Okay. So did you find that they were interested in this kind of model as a way to provide
clothing
for, like, a better outreach? Did they were excited about this,
or
they found that this was, like, taking over the time that they wanted? Like, how did they do that?
Mm-hmm. I think both. I think they really felt more effective because they were really able to through their supervision of care group volunteers, do behavior change activities and reach, you know, all the households. But it was, you know, additional time. And some, during our final evaluation of it, we asked specifically about that. And some, you know, community health workers reported no problem, were completely fine with the amount of time it took. And others really struggled with it and how much time, you know, it took from their time away harvesting in the fields. And I think a lot of it had to do with the geography and where they lived. Burundi is an extremely mountainous country, and if they lived in a place where that was super rural with tons of mountains, you know, just to walk to meetings to a place, a central location, took up a lot of time. So it's a key consideration. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We developed quality improvement checklists, which are sort of a core tool that a lot of care group projects use, which are sort of like a standard checklist showing, you know, what a training should entail and, you know, what a home visit should entail. And we found that to be a really easy tool for, you know, the health facility staff who were supervising the community health workers and then the community health workers who were supervising care group volunteers to use. But we did implement it sort of belatedly, once we realized that this was really something that we needed to be providing a bit more structure in. Yeah. Uh-huh. I think in the case of this research, I think we collected too much data. We looked at 40 indicators as a measure of, you know, is the traditional model at least as good? And, like, that's just a lot to draw conclusions on. I also think that we could have looked at additional data around functionality, like the quality of the care group meetings. I think it would have been good to look at that like as a real solid indicator. But in terms of, you know, community health volunteers collecting and reporting data, and even the care group volunteers collecting and reporting data, it was, you know, fairly seamless. There's definitely questions around the quality of the data that was collected, but I think we worked a lot with simplifying and really being strategic about what was, you know, absolutely essential for these community health workers to be collecting, and really worked hard to whittle away at that, and that actually worked. Ended up being fairly smooth.
I would like to know more about how you controlled the diagnosis rate for the patients and how you have a various cascade model of transferring messages or training.
Mm-hmm. So this is actually, it's a great question, and this is one of the wonderful things about the care group model. So the care group model uses drip training, as they call it. So it's like a very short time in between the receipt of a training and then the time where you go and disseminate that. So care group volunteers themselves receive training once a month, and after receiving the training on that topic, they then, that's sort of the message that they are meant to distribute or disseminate that month. And we did that sort of on a quarterly basis for the health facility staff, and then the health facility staff would then train the CHW on a monthly basis, who would then train the community health volunteers or the care group volunteers on a monthly basis. And inevitably, I do think there is a little bit that gets lost, but I think that by doing it in that sort of bit by bit, that was a real eye-opener for our project staff as well. Like, what do you mean we don't just do the big training at the beginning of the project and then move on to something else? You know, that this is something you do little by little, and that really helps with the quality. Okay, I'm going to hand it back over to Sarah. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
And be thinking about questions that might be interesting to hear across these different experiences. Our final speaker is not Jennifer Weiss, Michelle Kaufman. And I'm going to call Michelle up. And
am I able to move this back down there?
I think it goes. Upload just my video and not the presentation.
Okay, actually, I'm going to ask Jennifer to speak on one more question that I had while Michelle is loading her presentation again. And I think a number of us are curious about how the process of having the health facility staff take on the role of animator, mm-hmm. And how that went and what kind of accommodations you had to make happen to make that work. I don't know if you can come up and speak to that real fast while Michelle is getting set up.
It
was definitely a trial and error at the beginning. I think what worked in our favor was that health facility staff were already, you know, responsible for supervising CHWs anyway, in their role of doing, you know, community case management. And even if the CHWs in the traditional area weren't tasked with supervising care groups, they were still sort of, you know, meant to be doing that. The main accommodation and the main sort of learning that we realized was that we had originally decided that, okay, the head nurse of the health center is going to be our main, like, animator person. And we just realized, like, they just have way too much to do. They have the running the health center, the sort of the most senior staff there, they have way too many responsibilities. So we ended up switching halfway through the project to work with a more junior nurse who we just sort of called a focal point. And that actually ended up working much, much better. They had way more time to dedicate to these things and were way more involved and were actually able to leave the health center and go and do supervision in the community. So I think that's a big learning that we had and would recommend for other people.
Great. Thank you. Thanks, Jennifer. And now I think we've got Michelle's presentation up.
Yeah, I have this cute little video at the end that we were having trouble with, and the guys uploaded the video, and then we lost the presentation. So it's back. My name is Michelle Kaufman. I am a researcher at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health Center for Communication Programs, or JHUCCP for short. I lead all of our research in Malawi, Ethiopia, and Tanzania, and I'm going to be talking about a recent project we did in Tanzania working with children to prevent and treat malaria and change behavior. So the program I'm going to talk about is under the COMMIT project, which is a behavior change communication project that focuses on the prevention, treatment, and control of malaria. And it's funded by the President's Malaria Initiative through USAID. And the focus of the project is on consistent use of bed nets, malaria in pregnancy, case management for children under 5, and indoor residual spraying. So we have a large mobilization component that's on the ground in half of the regions in the country, those with the highest prevalence of malaria. And national media supports campaigns and programs such as the radio program I'm going to talk about, which is called Pata Pata. So Pata in Swahili means get. So like in English, we might say like, get it, get it. Well, in Swahili, you say pata pata, it means get it. And we are thinking about children getting information about malaria. So this is a 44-episode radio program aimed at children ages 6 to 12 years old. Each episode is 10 minutes. So in the first half, they have this interactive, they have this drama. And then in the last 5 minutes, they have an interactive component where they have quizzes and games that the children can participate in. Pata Pata is aired on 14 national radio stations on Saturday mornings, and it's part of a traditional children's radio hour. So at the time of production, most of the malaria BCC activities in Tanzania were geared towards caretakers of children under 5. And we decided to try to reach children so that they could become the agents of change in their households and in their communities. Now, I don't have children, but I understand that if people with children, children are very good at getting what they want. They will ask over and over again. So we thought that might be a great way to change behavior in these households and communities is if we got kids to engage in that process. So Pata Pata was this edutainment radio program. So we were looking to entertain the kids, but also to give them information on malaria. And the other thing I should mention is that there were some listening groups. I know this is mentioned in the other presentation. But we have community change agents as part of the COMMIT project, and in some of the regions where we are working, these CCAs, as we call them, would lead listening groups for children at the radio stations or in the communities. So prior to the rollout of Pata Pata, we distributed wind-up and solar radios to the CCAs and materials, facilitation guides, so that they could lead programs with kids, particularly for those who came from families that didn't have access to radios. So research at the time really showed that people in Tanzania looked at malaria as a fact of life. So we really wanted to increase people's perceptions of malaria as being a dangerous thing, as something severe, and that it should be taken very seriously. So while this was a children's radio show, we wanted children to talk to their families about this and get involved in ways to prevent and treat it. So we know children cannot go out and buy mosquito nets or take someone to the clinic if they're showing symptoms of malaria, but they can certainly ask to have their bed net put down at night or to urge a family member or someone they see in their community to go to the clinic if they're sick. So just a little synopsis of the Pata Pata story. It's about a little boy named Kinara, who's a very smart kid, but he and his friend Mau are always in trouble with this woman in their community. And she doesn't have very good information about malaria. And then Kinara is also in conflict with Annie Anopheles, who speaks to Kinara. He's the only one who can hear her. And she is a malaria-transmitting mosquito. She always tries to trick him with wrong information about malaria. But in each episode, he is able to unravel the truth about malaria and outsmart her. So we did a post-hoc qualitative evaluation of the program, and we did this in three different regions, Mwanza, Morogoro, and Mtwara, representing the north, central, and southern parts of the country. We did this with children who had listened to at least three episodes of Pata Pata. In each of the regions, we did two focus groups with children ages 10 to 12, so the older kids we were targeting, 10 in-depth interviews with children ages 8 to 12, and then we interviewed the parents and guardians of those children who participated in interviews. And then we also did two key informant interviews in each region with teachers and CCAs who led these listening groups. So interview topics that we covered, we wanted to know if the children understood what the Pata Pata radio program was and what the purpose was. We asked them to recall characters, asked them about their favorite ones and the ones they didn't like, what their understanding was of malaria, what they've learned from the program, whether they actually discussed the program with anyone or malaria in general, and any behavior change that they engaged in related to Pata Pata. So we did all of the interviews in Kiswahili with local field workers, audio recorded them, transcribed them, translated them into English, and then coded them using two independent coders and Atlas TI software. So just some general findings. First thing we needed to do was to get kids to like the program, to really engage them and make sure that they were interested in listening to it every week. And we found that the children loved it, particularly the interactive parts. They liked all the games and quizzes that they got to participate in. And I love this quote. One little girl from Mwanza said, "I feel happy when I hear Pata Pata, like I am at a party." One of the CCAs that we interviewed in Mtwara said that there are also parents who tell me their kids dream about Pata Pata in their sleep. So it was neat to see the radio program sort of really play into these children's lives and for them to become so involved in it. Parents and community members that we interviewed generally liked it, although a few of the respondents weren't really sure why we were trying to teach kids about malaria. They thought this isn't something that kids should really worry about. It's the adults. It's an adult issue. But in general, the adults liked the program as well and liked that their kids were listening to it. All of the children that we interviewed were able to talk about Pata Pata's discussion of malaria. They were able to speak about Anopheles mosquitoes, common symptoms of malaria, ways to treat it. And these are just a couple of representative quotes. One 12-year-old boy from Mtwara said, "When you feel headache, cold, and sleep for 1.5 days, you know you are suffering from malaria." And a little girl from Morogoro said, "We should clean the garbage and not keep water in the empty coconut shells. We should not keep ponds, so not allow standing water for mosquitoes to breed." We're also able to see in our data that the children who participated in the listening groups led by the CCAs provide a lot more detail about what they learned from the program than did the kids who were just listening in their homes alone. In terms of kids passing on what they learn to others, we heard a lot of stories about children educating other family members, particularly their parents and grandmothers came up a lot. Okay. There were also other community members, but these were the most common ones. One mother said, she was talking about her daughter, she will convince us on mosquito net use. She will remind me when I have forgotten to fix the net on my bed. She will always remind me on the uses of a net and that malaria is a bad disease. And then a little girl from the same region said, I've talked to my grandfather and grandmother. I told them we have to sleep in treated mosquito nets, to wash them when they get dirty, and hang them to dry in the shade. To my sister, that under 5 years old children should sleep in treated mosquito nets. And finally, in terms of behavior change, children reported a lot of changes happening with their own behavior or within their households, with their friends. And the most common one reported was that these children are now sleeping under bed nets every night. And the parents confirmed this behavior when we interviewed them. Other things children reported in terms of behavior change included cleaning up the environment, such as removing stagnant water, and encouraging others to go to the hospital or clinic when they saw symptoms. And just a couple of representative quotes. A little boy from Morogoro said, in the past, I was so lazy in placing the mosquito net over the bed, but right now, after being educated, I do place it. And a little girl in Matwara said, one day our group visited a group of pregnant ladies. We told them to use insecticide-treated mosquito nets and get a dosage of SP. So these kids became sort of the authorities on malaria in their community. So just overall conclusions, we feel that the Pata Pata radio program was an effective way to educate kids about malaria, and the children clearly enjoyed the program and looked forward to the weekly episodes. And listening to the program led to behavior change in the children's families. And so I was in country during data collection and was in Mwanza overseeing some of the field workers just hanging out with some kids while the interviews were going on. And the kids were asking me what I was doing there, and I told them we were talking to people about Pata Pata. And spontaneously, this whole group of kids just broke into the theme song, right? So I got it on video, and it's really cute, but it's sideways in, I don't even know if I'll be able to show it now that we, let's see. So no, this is, it turns it into a picture instead of a video. Actually, I can get it from my, so it's going to be sideways, but you'll get the, it's only 30 seconds. About the program and the fact that we were there talking to people about it. So just acknowledgments to the rest of my team. Thank you.